Good afternoon. This is Read Me Something You Love, and we are here at City University for a second time running. We were here last week as well, and here with Katie Darby, author of The Whore's Asylum. Not only author of The Whore's Asylum, also an editor, creative writing teacher, writer of musicals. Katie also is one of the main forces behind the Liars League monthly short story jamboree evenings, a live fiction night where professional actors read new short stories from writers around the world. And an evening that I've sort of become kind of addicted to. It's quite an amazing concept. I think
fictional crack.
it is a little bit like that. And it's our second meeting. Last week we recorded some passages, and we're going to hear Katie's readings of those from last week. So you chose for us two passages from Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White.
Mm-hmm.
And the first passage we're going to hear is... Would you like to just introduce the passage before your former self reads it?
Oh, yes. Okay, sure. So the first passage is Walter Hartwright is a drawing teacher, and he's the protagonist of The Woman in White. And he has been living in Hampstead, you know, kind of teaching young ladies to sketch. And he's just got a job up in Cumbria, I think, just south of Scotland. And he's going to teach two aristocratic young ladies in a remote manor house. You know, all the tropes of Gothic start coming in here already. In a remote country house, he's going to teach them drawing. He's going to be like the live-in drawing instructor. And he's come to say goodbye to his family and friends. So he's just leaving the house in Hampstead, his mother's place. And he's actually walking back to his lodgings in central London. And he has an interesting encounter on the way.
Okay. So it's the 14th of March today. Let's listen to the 7th of March, Katie, reading this. And then we'll talk a little bit about it.
The heat had been painfully oppressive all day, and it was now a close and sultry night. My mother and sister had spoken so many last words and had begged me to wait another 5 minutes so many times that it was nearly midnight when the servant locked the garden gate behind me. I walked forward a few paces on the shortest way back to London, then stopped and hesitated. The moon was full and broad in the dark blue starless sky, and the broken ground of the heath looked wild enough in the mysterious light to be hundreds of miles away from the great city that lay beneath it. The idea of descending any sooner than I could help into the heat and gloom of London repelled me. The prospect of going to bed in my airless chambers and the prospect of gradual suffocation seemed, in my present restless frame of mind and body, to be one and the same thing. I determined to stroll home in the purer air by the most roundabout way I could take, to follow the white winding paths across the lonely heath, and to approach London through its most open suburb by striking into the Finchley Road, and so getting back in the cool of the new morning by the western side of the Regent's Park. I wound my way down slowly over the heath, enjoying the divine stillness of the scene and admiring the soft alternations of light and shade as they followed each other over the broken ground on every side of me. So long as I was proceeding through this first and prettiest part of my night walk, my mind remained passively open to the impressions produced by the view, and I thought but little on any subject. Indeed, so far as my own sensations were concerned, I can hardly say that I thought at all. But when I had left the heath and had turned into the byroad, where there was less to see, the ideas naturally engendered by the approaching change in my habits and occupations gradually drew more and more of my attention exclusively to themselves. By the time I had arrived at the end of the road, I had become completely absorbed in my own fanciful visions of Limeridge House, of Mr. Fairley, and of the two ladies whose practice in the art of watercolour painting I was so soon to superintend. I had now arrived at that particular point of my walk where four roads met: the road to Hampstead, along which I had returned, the road to Finchley, the road to West End, and the road back to London. I had mechanically turned in this latter direction and was strolling along the lonely high road, idly wondering, I remember, what the Cumberland young ladies would look like, when, in one moment, every drop of blood in my body was brought to a stop by the touch of a hand laid lightly and suddenly on my shoulder from behind me. I turned on the instant, with my fingers tightening round the handle of my stick. There, in the middle of the broad, bright high road, there, as if it had that moment sprung out of the earth or dropped from the heaven, stood the figure of a solitary woman, dressed from head to foot in white garments, her face bent in grave inquiry on mine, her hand pointing to the dark cloud over London as I faced her. I was far too seriously startled by the suddenness with which this extraordinary apparition stood before me in the dead of night and in that lonely place to ask what she wanted. The strange woman spoke first. "Is that the road to London?" she said. I looked attentively at her as she put that singular question to me. It was then nearly 1 o'clock. All I could discern distinctly by the moonlight was a colourless, youthful face, meagre and sharp to look at about the cheeks and chin, large, grave, wistfully attentive eyes, nervous, uncertain lips, and light hair of a pale brownish-yellow hue. There was nothing wild, nothing immodest in her manner. It was quiet and self-controlled. A little melancholy and a little touched by suspicion, not exactly the manner of a lady, and at the same time not the manner of a woman in the humblest rank of life. The voice, little as I had yet heard of it, had something curiously still and mechanical in its tones, and the utterance was remarkably rapid. She held a small bag in her hand, and her dress, bonnet, shawl, and gown, all of white, was, so far as I could guess, certainly not composed of very delicate or very expensive materials. Her figure was slight, and rather above the average height, her gait and actions free from the slightest approach to extravagance. This was all that I could observe of her in the dim light and under the perplexingly strange circumstances of our meeting. What sort of a woman she was, and how she came to be out alone in the high road an hour after midnight, I altogether failed to guess. The one thing of which I felt certain was that the grossest of mankind could not have misconstrued her motive in speaking, even at that suspiciously late hour, and in that suspiciously lonely place. "Did you hear me?" she said, still quietly and rapidly, and without the least fretfulness or impatience. "I asked if that was the way to London." Yes, I replied. "That is the way. It leads to St. John's Wood and the Regent's Park." "You must excuse my not answering you before. I was rather startled by your sudden appearance in the road, and I am, even now, quite unable to account for it." "You don't suspect me of doing anything wrong, do you?" "I have done nothing wrong. I have met with an accident. I am very unfortunate in being here alone so late. Why do you suspect me of doing wrong?" She spoke with unnecessary earnestness and agitation, and shrank back from me several paces. I did my best to reassure her. "Pray don't suppose that I have any idea of suspecting you," I said, "or any other wish than to be of assistance to you if I can. I only wondered at your appearance in the road, because it seemed to me to be empty the instant before I saw you." She turned and pointed back to a place at the junction of the road to London and the road to Hampstead, where there was a gap in the hedge. "I heard you coming," she said, "and hid there to see what sort of man you were before I risked speaking. I doubted and feared about it till you passed, and then I was obliged to steal after you and touch you." Steal after me and touch me? Why not call to me? Strange, to say the least of it. "May I trust you?" she asked. You don't think the worst of me because I have met with an accident. She stopped in confusion, shifted her bag from one hand to the other, and sighed bitterly. The loneliness and helplessness of this woman touched me. The natural impulse to assist her and to spare her got the better of the judgment, the caution, the worldly tact, which an older, wiser, and colder man might have summoned to help him in this strange emergency. You may trust me for any harmless purpose, I said. If it troubles you to explain your strange situation to me, don't think of returning to the subject again. I have no right to ask you for any explanations. Tell me how I can help you, and if I can, I will. You are very kind, and I am very, very thankful to have met you. The first touch of womanly tenderness that I had heard from her trembled in her voice as she said the words. But no tears glistened in those large, wistful eyes of hers, which were still fixed on me. I have only been in London once before, she went on, more and more rapidly, and I know nothing about that side of it yonder. Can I get a fly, or a carriage of any kind? Is it too late? I don't know. If you could show me where to get a fly, and if you will only promise not to interfere with me, and to let me leave you when and how I please, I have a friend in London who will be glad to receive me. I want nothing else. Will you promise? She looked anxiously up and down the road, shifted her bag again from one hand to the other, repeated the words, "Will you promise?" and looked hard in my face, with a pleading fear and confusion that it troubled me to see. What could I do? Here was a stranger, utterly and helplessly at my mercy, and that stranger a forlorn woman. No house was near, no one was passing whom I could consult, and no earthly right existed on my part to give me a power of control over her, even if I had known how to exercise it. I traced these lines self-distrustfully, with the shadows of after events darkening the very paper I write on. And still I say, what could I do?
Great. Fantastic. Fantastic reading. No, that's fine. So he's walking home from Hampstead, and it's this close and sultry night.
Yeah, and I know that area pretty well, actually.
And it's quite strange. I don't know how you find it, but I find it really strange to be walking that route, you know, whatever it is, 150, 200 years in the past, because it still is a little bit like that. And yet at the same time, of course, you know, he talks about the city looming in the distance. Well, now the city has pretty much swallowed up.
Absolutely, yes. There's no
that is now
question
London.
Of distance. I mean, the heath obviously still exists, and the wildness of the heath is still there. And that's, I guess, the link that comes down to us from history is that Hampstead Heath hasn't changed, thank goodness. But yes, the city in the distance, and Hampstead Heath was a little tiny village, and, you know, very much as it is today in terms of the architecture, except that it was separated from London. It was sort of a satellite village. And if you wanted to walk home, well, you know, you'd be walking through effectively country lanes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it so spooky. This encounter that he has, you know, and the woman kind of coming out of nowhere, because whereas now if you're walking that route, there'll be cars sort of zooming past you, even if you are going there at 1 a.m. But no, it's completely silent and kind of solemn and kind of mistrouded. So she really surprises the hell out of him. He never thought he would meet anyone on the way back, I think.
And he's sort of in a kind of a reverie, isn't he? You know, I wound my way down slowly over... I love that the line, I wound my way down slowly over the heath, enjoying the divine stillness of the scene, admiring the soft alternations of light and shade as they followed each other over the broken ground on every side of me. So he's sort of in his own little world.
Yeah.
And then it's almost a sort of a dreamlike space, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's that thing, you know, when you're walking or when you're running, I guess, some people, you know, sort of jogging certain routes, you get into a slightly trance state and you're wandering along, but because, you know, your body's pretty damn good at walking, it knows how to, and if it's a well-known route, you just follow it automatically. As before, when I led you in the maze of city and I was actually going towards the short courses office, which is where I normally go. So your body just kind of goes onto autopilot and your mind floats free. And it's this kind of slightly trance-like state into which she intrudes. But what I really like about this description is Collins does, great physical descriptions. You know, he's a brilliant creator of atmosphere. But he doesn't just do atmosphere. He doesn't just paint a lovely picture. He then puts exciting characters in it and has extraordinary things happen. So I feel like you get the best of both worlds. But there's this lovely... the moon was full and broad in the dark blue starless sky, mm-hmm. and the broken ground of the heath looked wild enough in the mysterious light to be hundreds of miles away. Yeah, and that, I think, is also, it's not just Collins, it's Walter Hartwright, the painter, thinking, oh, wow, I could do a lovely moonscape of this, couldn't I? You know, come out in the middle of the night and paint the heath. And he's using all this descriptive language and he's, almost not literally painting a picture, but he's painting a picture in our minds in the same way that he might get out, the canvas and paint something in his normal life. So I think it's justified. It really reflects the character the way he describes.
And there's still, and particularly that description, I think there still is something very much of Hampstead Heath that is still like that. I'm thinking particularly on a kind of a summer's night, those Kenwood concerts. I never did you ever go to those?
I haven't actually. I've been on the Heath.
Picnics.
Twilight.
It still does have that kind of stillness and even a sort of a slight spookiness.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's great, and it's one of the few aspects of London, I think, that hasn't changed in those intervening years.
So he's wandering along in this timeless, spaced out space, sort of almost like the last man on earth in a way, and then suddenly out she pops.
Absolutely, yeah, it's like a rabbit out of a hat. Yeah, no, she comes through the gap in the hedge, and because the road is so lonely and because you can see so far and he's seen there's no one on the road, he walks along and then she taps him on the shoulder from behind. And that's such a brilliant, like, horror movie jump moment. There's nothing in front of you because you can see, and then someone touches you on the shoulder, you're like, ah! you jump a mile. And she, she subsequently explains her magical appearance. But there's, it's not a ghost story, but it is a very spooky story, The Woman in White. You know, there's no supernatural happenings, but there's all sorts of, dastardliness going on and things that seem inexplicable. Like, for example, her first appearance. He doesn't know where the hell she's come from. Then she says, oh, no, I hid behind the hedge to make sure you're a nice man, and then I came out when I thought I could trust you, and that's why he hasn't heard her or seen her. But it's a brilliant kind of moment of shock, and that means there's something ghostly, her kind of dressed all in white as well. There is something ghostly about her, even though he knows that she's a flesh and blood woman. I'd wet myself if someone did that to me on the middle of the road in the middle of the night. But the character's name is Anne, and it transpires that she is, she's a little bit what they would have called touched or simple, and she is not really able to be around people sort of unchaperoned. She's normally looked after by her mother. She's not stupid, but it's more of, I guess, what they would call it, like a behavioural thing or a personality type disorder. Anyway, she doesn't quite get it. And so she'll come up to this strange man not fearing anything from him because he is dressed nice. And she's been taught to trust people who look like gentlemen. Now, he could be very much not a gentleman, and I think, he says that as well. But she needs something, she needs help, and she's very direct in asking for it. And that's another, another aspect of her spookiness, that kind of slightly mechanical, that automaton-like behaviour, you know, in pursuit of her goal, which is, what's the way to London? Can I get a carriage? You know, all that sort of thing. None of the social niceties, oh, excuse me, sir.
Exactly.
Forgive me for bothering you.
Yeah. And there's something quite seductive, I think, about that. I think there is something, and perhaps there's something seductive about insanity to a certain extent, because it just cuts through all of the civilities, doesn't it? It actually allows somebody to approach one human being, to approach another human being, and to be immediately quite intimate with them.
I think he's pretty startled by it, you know, he's not too thrilled, but he recognizes that she needs his help. She's not soliciting, and she's not a beggar or anything like that. She's not after money. What Anne has is that genuine desperation, really. And he can tell that all she wants from him is information, uh-huh. perhaps, you know, protection should it be necessary, but she really just wants to get away. And I mean, the seductiveness of insanity, I think that certainly is true in literary characters. We wouldn't often want to be around someone like, for example, Patrick Bateman in American Psycho, but as a literary character, he is fascinating, because those of us who are quote-unquote sane don't often get insight into the workings of the mind of people. I think, you know, also for a gothic novel, you've got to have a villain. And The Woman in White's got a brilliant villain as well. Now, he's not crazy. He is very sane, very intelligent, completely together. Count Fosco. And yet he's eccentric. He's this bizarre, kind of grotesquely fat, extremely eloquent and confident Italian guy with a very jealous wife, and he keeps these white mice, they're his little pets, and birds as well. I think he has birds, and the white mice just sort of run up and down his clothes, and they're his little pets, and they peek out near his ears, and he just plays with them. So he's got an eccentric quality to him, but actually he's got a mind like a steel trap. But he's a brilliant villain because he knows exactly what he's doing.
Sounds a little bit like Boris Johnson, actually. You just described him there.
All Boris needs is some white mice and he'll win the next election. Yeah, that's a thought. Yeah. Get yourself a cuddly animal and it really works.
Well, let's return to Mr. Collins. And so the next passage, we're a week or two past this first meeting, aren't we?
Yes, that's right. I think it might not even be that long, because he's meant to be going off the night that he meets the Woman in White. I think he's going off the next day to Limeridge House. So it might even only be a couple of days. I can't remember. But it's not long at all, anyway. And now he's somewhere completely different, in a totally different environment, and meets one of his students, Marianne Halcombe, for the first time. When I rose the next morning and drew up my blind, the sea opened before me joyously under the broad August sunlight, and the distant coast of Scotland fringed the horizon with its lines of melting blue. The view was such a surprise and such a change to me after my weary London experience of brick and mortar landscape that I seemed to burst into a new life and a new set of thoughts the moment I looked at it. A confused sensation of having suddenly lost my familiarity with the past without acquiring any additional clearness of idea in reference to the present or the future took possession of my mind. Circumstances that were but a few days old faded back in my memory as if they had happened months and months since. Pesca's quaint announcement of the means by which he had procured me my present employment, the farewell evening I had passed with my mother and sister, even my mysterious adventure on the way home from Hampstead, had all become like events which might have occurred at some former epoch of my existence. Although the Woman in White was still in my mind, the image of her seemed to have grown dull and faint already. A little before 9 o'clock, I descended to the ground floor of the house.
The solemn manservant of the night before met me wandering along the passages and compassionately showed me the way to the breakfast room. My first glance round me, as the man opened the door, disclosed a well-furnished breakfast table standing in the middle of a long room with many windows in it. I looked from the table to the window farthest from me and saw a lady standing at it, with her back turned towards me. The instant my eyes rested on her, I was struck by the rare beauty of her form and by the unaffected grace of her attitude. Her figure was tall, yet not too tall, comely and well-developed, yet not fat. Her head set on her shoulders with an easy, pliant firmness, her waist perfection in the eyes of a man, for it occupied its natural place, it filled out its natural circle, it was visibly and delightfully undeformed by stays. She had not heard my entrance into the room, and I allowed myself the luxury of admiring her for a few moments before I moved one of the chairs near me as the least embarrassing means of attracting her attention. She turned towards me immediately. The easy elegance of every movement of her limbs and body, as soon as she began to advance from the far end of the room, set me in a flutter of expectation to see her face clearly. She left the window, and I said to myself, "The lady is dark." She moved forward a few steps, and I said to myself, "The lady is young." She approached nearer, and I said to myself, with a sense of surprise which words fail me to express, "The lady is ugly." Never was the old conventional maxim that nature cannot err more flatly contradicted. Never was the fair promise of a lovely figure more strangely and startlingly belied by the face and head that crowned it. The lady's complexion was almost swarthy, and the dark down on her upper lip was almost a moustache. She had a large, firm, masculine mouth and jaw, prominent, piercing, resolute brown eyes, and thick, coal-black hair growing unusually low down on her forehead. Her expression, bright, frank, and intelligent, appeared, while she was silent, to be altogether wanting in those feminine attractions of gentleness and pliability without which the beauty of the handsomest woman alive is beauty incomplete. To see such a face as this, set on shoulders that a sculptor would have longed to model, to be charmed by the modest graces of action through which the symmetrical limbs betrayed their beauty when they moved, and then to be almost repelled by the masculine form and masculine look of the features in which the perfectly shaped figure ended, was to feel a sensation oddly akin to the helpless discomfort familiar to us all in sleep, when we recognise, yet cannot reconcile, the anomalies and contradictions of a dream. "Mr. Hartwright," said the lady interrogatively, her dark face lighting up with a smile and softening and growing womanly the moment she began to speak. "We resigned all hope of you last night and went to bed as usual. Accept my apologies for our apparent want of attention, and allow me to introduce yourself as one of your pupils. Shall we shake hands? I suppose you must come to it sooner or later, and why not sooner?" These odd words of welcome were spoken in a clear, ringing, pleasant voice. The offered hand, rather large but beautifully formed, was given to me with the easy, unaffected self-reliance of a highly bred woman. We sat down together at the breakfast table in as cordial and customary a manner as if we had known each other for years, and had met at Limeridge House to talk over old times by previous appointment. "I hope you come here good-humouredly determined to make the best of your position," continued the lady. "You will have to begin this morning by putting up with no other company at breakfast than mine. My sister is in her own room, nursing that essentially feminine malady, a slight headache, and her old governess, Mrs. Veazey, is charitably attending on her with restorative tea. My uncle, Mr. Fairley, never joins us at any of our meals. He is an invalid and keeps bachelor state in his own apartments. There is nobody else in the house but me. Two young ladies have been staying here, but they went away yesterday in despair, and no wonder. All through their visit, in consequence of Mr. Fairley's invalid condition, we produced no such convenience in the house as a flirtable, danceable, small-talkable creature of the male sex. And the consequence was we did nothing but quarrel, especially at dinner time. How can you expect four women to dine together alone every day and not quarrel? We are such fools, we can't entertain each other at table. You see, I don't think much of my own sex, Mr. Hartwright. Which will you have, tea or coffee? No woman does think much of her own sex, although few of them confess it as freely as I do. Dear me, you look puzzled. Why? Are you wondering what you will have for breakfast? Or are you surprised at my careless way of talking? In the first case, I advise you, as a friend, to have nothing to do with that cold ham at your elbow and to wait till the omelette comes in. In the second case, I will give you some tea to compose your spirits and do all a woman can, which is very little, by the by, to hold my tongue.
Right. They are two fabulous... fabulous passages.
I love them. I love them. I just love her kind of rattling on. It's great because he establishes character and he describes her completely. He paints a picture and then she just completely takes over the scene. So yeah, it's great. I just really like her.
And this feels, particularly also from a kind of a male perspective, this feels very much a sort of a timeless male gaze, you know. You're coming up to somebody who looks very attractive and you just want to see what they look like, and everything's you're clocking everything and
you
it's
go,
all
okay,
looking
promising
great.
Promising great legs, lovely hair, and then turns around and it's a bloke or whatever.
and this is what happens here. You know, she moved forward, the lady's young, etc, etc,
tick, yes.
and it's quite shocking. The never has almost the word ugly felt so...
feels quite brutal to me.
Brutal.
Yeah, it is. But it's... I think that's a deliberate choice. You know, the lady is unattractive. It's a bit mimsy, isn't it? And it's... I think that is a verbal shock, which equates to the visual shock that he then gets, because, you know, by her lovely figure and her elegant grace and all the rest of it, he's being led to expect that she's going to have a lovely face to go with it, because, you know, otherwise, oh my God, you know, it's just unnatural. And so is the reader, you know. It's a little, it's a naughty little trick played on the reader, because we know that there is going to be a romance in this story. We know that young Walter Hartwright, who's single and talented and handsome and all the rest of it, is going to be paired up with somebody, and we think it's going to be the first woman he meets, particularly when we have this, you know, very admiring description of, you know, the way that she looks, the way she carries herself, of basically her from the neck down. We're like, oh, this is going to be the romantic heroine. They're going to turn around and there's going to be electricity between them. And it's not. And I just think it's a very clever piece of trickery. It's teasing us, saying, well, could it be her? Could it be her? Oh, no, it's not her. The minute it says the lady is ugly, we're like, OK, fine, she's not the heroine. Basically, as soon as I read the words the lady is ugly, I'm like, good, she's going to have a lot of character. She's going to be a really interesting addition to this book, and I look forward to hearing what she has to say and seeing what she's going to do. And again, you know, slap on the wrist, Wilkie and the Victorians. Because she's ugly, she's allowed to be interesting. And because she's interesting, she can't be pretty. And also, she's described, her face is described in masculine terms. He goes on about how feminine her figure is and then how masculine her face is, with her big jaw, and she's got a slight moustache and, you know, all this other stuff. And she has a masculine manner to her as well. And he's constantly invoking the fact that she is... she's kind of mannish in her way and in her looks, facially in her looks. And that is what disturbs him. That is what makes her ugly. I mean, apart from the moustache, you know, a large, firm, masculine mouth, you know, someone with a large, firm mouth and jaw, that's not inherently ugly at all.
No.
But it's because she's not conforming to expected, you know, the expected appearance and behaviour of a demure Victorian lady.
Because nowadays, I think we would find that striking, sexy. We would frame it in a completely different way.
Mm.
And yet, don't you think that there is still some of this kind of prejudice towards women who are not sort of girly girls?
And she separates herself consciously from the rest of her sex. She knows she's not going to get by in the world by being, you know, pretty, a lovely little ornament and flirting and giggling and, you know, playing with a toy poodle. That's not going to work, because in terms of how she's valued by the outside world, her face is her fortune and she's got nothing. So she knows that she could be as feminine as she likes. No one's going to respond, you know, people aren't going to give her respect unless she earns it. And that's what I like about her. And so she masculinizes herself. She separates herself from the kind of silly, giggly, general run of females. Although she makes one exception, of course, for her half-sister, who is Laura, who is, you know, she's not too insipid. She's not as bad as Dickens's women, believe me. But she is, you know, she's the classic Victorian heroine. She, you know, she's beautiful and she's loving, gentle, open-hearted, pliant, and he even says, you know, that pliancy, he says that's a feminine quality. You need to be kind of pliant and bendable and, you know, do what other people want you to. And that's the essence of femininity. And Marianne Halcombe is not that at all. And it, unfortunately, it sort of makes her a bit of a misogynistic woman. And that is harsh. But then again, if she's surrounded by women who have been brought up to be ornaments rather than, you know, objects of beauty rather than objects of inherent value, or just objects at all, then she probably is sick to the back teeth of, you know, silly tea parties where people talk about, you know, fabric patterns.
And she says here, you know, how can you expect four women to dine together alone every day and not quarrel? We are such fools. Mm. We can't entertain each other at table. She then says, where is it? You see, I don't think much of my own sex, Mr. Hartwright. No woman does think much of her own sex, although few of them confess it as freely as I do. And I just wonder, you know, I mean, one thing that has happened in the intervening time between when we last met was, of course, Women's Day. Yes.
Yeah, yes.
And I do wonder if...
Is this still true?
If this in some way is still true. I think of all those magazines of women journalists essentially ripping to shreds other women and all of their sort of flaws and their cellulite and their this and their that and the other. I mean, a lot of this still goes on, doesn't it?
It does still go on. And I think it's a great shame because, you know, as some commentators have said, the fight should not be with other women. It should be with people who are trying to, you know, keep women down or, you know, prevent their advancement or sort of self-realisation. But I think what Marianne is saying there is it's a sort of veiled reference to the perceived bitchiness of women. You know, she says, I don't think much of my own sex. And by the way, she says, oh, we're all fools. But she's being ironic, and we know that she doesn't include herself in that. It's like, no, they're all fools. But I have to be there. Are you trapped by my gender? I have to go to these bloody tea parties and, you know, listen to people talk about frocks. I'm not interested in that. You know, I want to do my own thing. I think it does still happen, which is a great shame. I think, you know, things have got considerably better for women, thank goodness, but it's not like there isn't, you know, much further to go. And yes, you do see that kind of internecine strife, you know. I was going to say girl on girl, but that sounds, you know, inappropriately pornographic. But that kind of, you know, women having a go at other women who are successful. And also the endless problem, which is, you know, if a woman is working in a male-dominated environment, does she have to take on aspects of, you know, masculinity? Does she have to become, scare quotes, hard and dominant and, you know, a bit of a, again, scare quotes, bitch? And if she doesn't do that, Will she then be accused of using her gender to flirt with people and get advantage that way? You know, you can't win. I think you know, Marianne thinks a lot of the women she's met in her life are silly and would probably prefer the company of men most of the time. And I think there are probably a number of women who are working in, you know, very competitive fields, which are perhaps male-dominated, who might also, you know, have some of that attitude. But, you know, as ever, you know, women have always been encouraged to be pretty and silly, because that way, you know, it's quite easy to keep them in their place. So, I don't think it's just Marianne who's down on women. I think she's an expression of her times, and the only way she can be who she wants to be is to push away the cliches of her gender and say, no, I'm not like those girls. I am a woman, but you know, you pretty much wouldn't know it. She's got so many good positive masculine qualities, you know, resourcefulness, intelligence, and all that stuff. And it's just a shame that they're perceived as masculine qualities rather than human qualities.